And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to Spin Rate, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. What is up? Welcome back to Spin Rate, your Toronto Blue Jays podcast here on the Athletic Network. My name is Drew Fairservice, and yes, we're going to talk about your Toronto Blue Jays. We're recording this here on Sunday evening. Today is Mother's Day, so happy Mother's Day to all the mothers and grandmothers and would-be mothers and former mothers and everybody. I hope everybody had a great day. Baseball did their eyewash, pink eyewash thing where they rightly raised lots of money for the Pink Ribbon campaign for breast cancer research. But of course, baseball's actual track record when it comes to pink things is not quite as strong as we sit here and speak. Still no word on Mickey Callaway and what is to become of him. Today, you ordinarily, me here on the Sunday show with my co-host Caitlin McGrath, who is, of course, the Blue Jays writer for TheAthletic.com. Caitlin is off this weekend. So she's been busy writing about the myriad transactions that the Toronto Blue Jays are making as one player after another is added to the injured list. I would recommend, if you haven't already, you go to theathletic.com/spinrate and you subscribe. And then you can read everything that Caitlin writes, and you can read everything that everyone writes about baseball, about the footy, about the Raptors, whose season is, I believe, either over or winding down. Hockey still inexplicably going on. All of those exciting sports and the boring ones too. Go to theathletic.com/spinrate. Subscribe. If you haven't subscribed to the pod, I think you should do that. Wherever it is you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and the list goes on. Wherever you catch a pod, sign up for Spinrate. Hit us with the review. Hit us with the like. But because Caitlin is off this weekend, it is my pleasure at this time to be joined by my friend. You read him on The Score for many, many years. He is the former host of the Expand the Zone podcast. And not only is he all of those things, those are his professional credentials. He is also one half of the battery in probably in all of Toronto men's baseball league history that has the most Twitter followers. Mr. Jonah Birnbaum. Jonah, thank you for taking the time and subbing in here on a Sunday.
My pleasure, pal. I'm but a poor substitute for Caitlin McGrath, the incomparably erudite Caitlin McGrath, but I'll do my best.
Caitlin does good work. We're glad that she's taking some time to rest and recharge because the transactions, they just keep coming at us. Just like you and I were involved in a transaction, as I said, battery, we were traded from the Sox to the Dodgers where we won a title, Toronto Men's Baseball League title. Of course, we won because I wasn't there. I was not there at the championship game, but Jonah, did you pitch in the final game?
I believe I did. Yeah. I think I was first out of the pen.
First out of the pen. So Tyson, you, and then Miguel in the end.
That's right.
And you caught Miguel at the end, didn't you?
I did. Yeah.
So that's Jonah's the emergency catcher when I'm not around. That's how we roll.
Versatility, you know?
Versatility. So Jonah, if you don't know, has a three pitch mix. That is a 1-2.5 pitch mix.
That's very generous.
And he insists on the changeup, and every so often he throws and gets himself into trouble. Today on Sunday, I think the number one thing that we'll talk about, of course, right now for the Blue Jays, not the Toronto Men's Baseball League Dodgers, blessed as they are and excited as we are, may or may not be to get back as we continue to get vaccinated, first and second doses. And if you haven't already, I guess if you live in Toronto, you live in Peel, you live in Durham, you live in New York, there's lots of opportunity for you to go out and get your shot. So if you haven't, I can't encourage you enough to do it. If it's in a mass clinic, if it's at the what are they called? The drugstore, lots of spots. Go get the shot when you can. And if you have questions,
If you have questions about it, you can even reach out to me. I'm not going to answer them, but I can point you in the right direction of some folks who can. But because it's fair to have questions. There's lots of people who have lots of questions for lots of valid reasons, but the answers are all out there. And I'd be more than happy to help you find the right information if you're looking for it. Looking for it was exactly what Nate Pearson was doing on the Hill today, because he looked like garbage. Nate Pearson, I made a show Nate Piertani joke because it looked like most Shohei Ohtani starts where he walked the ballpark. Nate Pearson walked five Astros today in what eventually was a 7-4 defeat at the hands of the dreaded Houston Astros. But it was really, there was excitement. Nate Pearson was kind of pressed into duty. For, you know, again, because one injury after another, they needed to make a move. Rafael Dolis had to go to the injured list. Pearson was the next guy up. He looked good in his first AAA start after, you know, obviously missing a ton of time in the spring. But man, he just had no clue where his fastball was going today. And it was an absolute, it was a shit show, frankly.
Yeah. And it continued this disconcerting pattern that I guess started last year of him not being able to perform at the major league level. And obviously it's the tiniest of samples. He's pitched in like a half dozen games, but it's odd and bewildering, frankly, how a consensus top two or three pitching prospect in the game, a guy who absolutely dominates in the minor leagues, comes up to the big leagues and loses it completely. It's not a quaint command issue that he has. It's that he has no idea where the baseball is going. And after his major league debut last year against Washington, that was the case for every subsequent start he made in 2020 until he went on the injured list ultimately for an extended period. And that's what we saw today, even though in his preceding start, which came on Tuesday for AAA Buffalo or Trenton, he was nails. He only threw 3 2/3, but he struck out 8 and he only walked 1. And then fast forward to Sunday in Houston, and he has no clue where the baseball is going. He generated 1 whiff. And this is what we've seen in his very, very brief major league career, which is that there is a complete Jekyll and Hyde act with Nate Pearson, where he is so, so good and earns all the plaudits and absolutely shoves against minor league competition, comes up to Toronto and just doesn't look like an elite pitching prospect. It's mystifying, frankly.
It's brutal. It's bad. And it's bad for a variety of different reasons. You know, there were some times where maybe you would accuse him of nibbling, right? Where that's been sort of the knock, where he was trying to be too fine. That was what, you know, Pat Tabler and Dan Shulman on the broadcast kind of, you know, Tabler in particular kept hitting on repeatedly. Like, he doesn't need to be so fine. He doesn't need to try to throw it to the corners. His stuff is great. He doesn't need to trust his stuff. All that sort of like patter, like the stuff we expect them to say when there's a guy up there who has no idea where the baseball is going, because that was the case today. It wasn't, there were a few, you know, just misses. You know, he's maybe in those cases he was trying to be too fine, going for the kind of bottom corner on the outside half of the plate against a right-handed batter, misses a couple inches outside. But for every one of those, there was one that was not even close. Like, completely yanked into the opposite batter's box. You know, he wasn't able to throw any of his pitches for strikes. I think he threw one changeup the entire time. He was throwing his curve or a slider, whatever. And, you know, just not well located at all. And you can see some of his post-game comments. He's talking about it's me versus me. And, it's, you know, I just got to see the mitt and hit the mitt and stuff. Like, that's the issue, I think. And I'm loath to play, you know, armchair psychologist. I don't want to say it's in his head, but there's no other realistic explanation that one could offer as to why he just not even command, but control with any of his pitches.
Yeah, the disparity between the minor league performance and what we've seen thus far at the major league level really does speak to some psychological thing that's going on and preventing him from not only dominating, but from simply being serviceable, because it doesn't make any sense. And if he was pitching like this in the minor leagues, he would not have close to the numbers that he's put up in his admittedly brief minor league career. And he wouldn't be as widely lauded as he is, but he just shows up and doesn't show up. It's like a completely different pitcher arrives when he slips on that Blue Jays uniform.
I'm glad you brought that up, because there was a guy that I was kind of going back and forth with a bit on Twitter, a guy that I've known online for a long, long time. Smart guy, like, not, you know, he's got his some takes, but he was like, this is who he's always been. He could get away with it in the minor leagues. And
No.
I don't think that that's true. Not without the ability to throw anything close, to be behind all the time. You know, he referenced, there was somebody, I can't remember who it was, might have been the, what's his name, he used to be Fangraphs, and then he's been back and forth, kind of worked for the Braves, and then he went back to Fangraphs, the prospect guy.
McDaniel?
Yeah, might have been Riley McDaniel. Riley McDaniel, right?
Kylie,
excuse me. He said, oh yeah, he had some questions about his fastball command. But like, this wasn't command at all. There was nothing about command. This wasn't, you know, there was one, so, and this is what I'm going to go somewhere from this. There was one fastball he left right in the middle of the plate, and I think it was Yuli Gurriel swung right through it. And then Pearson was like, kind of like miffy about it. And Tabler kind of caught it, like, oh, he wasn't happy with that last pitch, which I think speaks to a bigger thing. But like, you tell me, I don't think, if this was who he was in AAA, A, he would walk more than one. Right, he couldn't throw strikes for trying today, and it doesn't matter if who's up there. You know, these are professional hitters. It's not like we're talking about a kid that was, you know, like Dylan Bundy dominating, striking out 200 batters in 40 innings in high school, which is not possible. And then coming to the big leagues and not being able to throw strikes because in high school he was striking out you and I. And we're swinging as soon as his front foot hits, goes down. These are professional hitters. They're not going to swing it just shit that's thrown to the backstop, right? That's crazy.
Completely. I mean, this is AAA that we're talking about. You're one level away from the big leagues. A lot of the guys that he's pitching against have played in the big leagues. They have big league service time. They're not going to strike out 8 times in 3 2/3 innings when he's only recording, 11 outs. They're not going to strike out 8 times if he's consistently 3-0 on every guy, 2-0 on every guy, missing with non-competitive misses. Like, that just doesn't happen at such an advanced level of the minor leagues. So I'm led to believe that he just completely loses it, or it's a small sample, but on Sunday, certainly just lost whatever he had in his AAA debut on Tuesday. He lost it against the Astros.
We'll be right back with more Spin Rate, but first, check this out.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
I'm not making any kind of diagnosis, but to me, that one pitch sort of set, in some ways, kind of, it got my antenna up when that was a meatball that he threw, but he got away with it because it's 98.
96, yeah, whatever.
Or whatever it was. But to me, that's like the, Maybe that's the thing where it's like, okay, you made a mistake, but you got by. Flush it and get ready for the next pitch. Which, again, this is this whole mentality of pitching and the way that pitchers have to commit to every single pitch. You know, that's the difference between them and, you know, you or I or whatever. We're standing in the mound being like, man, I wish I hadn't had that, you know, 9th beer last night. I probably wouldn't feel like I was going to puke on the rubber right now. But like, you know, that ability to commit to that pitch and flush every single one that's come before is the difference. And the thing that I saw after that, that, again, number one, you know, I got a message, DM from somebody being like, what the hell is going on? And not wanting to overreact. They were like, Manoah's better than this right now. right? But, and then as I was messaging back and forth with this person, you see Pearson on the mound, like, talking to himself. So number one, he has like a little mini, like, because he made a mistake. Then he's just talking to himself. And then you see him in the dugout in between innings. So he gets out of the inning, right? Again, hardly anybody hit the ball hard. It was all kinds of, you know, lazy fly balls and whatever. Gets in the dugout. In my mind, if I'm putting myself in his place, flush it. You got out of the inning. You know, your pitch count's running. I'm going to go out and I'm going to pitch well in the third. If I go four today, that's a victory for me. All I got to do, I'm going to go out and I'm going to get three outs in the third inning. They show him in the dugout, pacing. Pacing, stomping up and down the dugout. And then they show him again. And he's like, he looked like he was got his hands on the rail, you know, the railing, the protective fencing that sits in front of the dugout. He's got his hands on it. He's hanging his head. His head's in the screen. He's just looking like he was wanted to die. And I'm just like, man, to me, again, I'm playing armchair psychologist. That's a rough look for a big leaguer who is allowed one earned run at that point.
It's because he doesn't recognize himself. Like the version of Nate Pearson that showed up on Sunday and that has showed up thus far in the big leagues does not resemble the Nate Pearson that has so thoroughly dominated the minor leagues. And that's a scary feeling because at every other stop, he has been the best pitcher on the roster. He's been the best pitcher on the field the days that he starts, and he is absolutely overpowering. It's never a struggle for him. And then he comes to the big leagues, and it's not only a struggle to find success, it's a struggle to just trust the process and to compete. He's not even competing when he's out there. And that's got to be a scary feeling for him. And, you know, I don't blame him for demonstrating that kind of sketchy body language, because that's got to be really uncomfortable for him.
I feel like there was a lot was made of his makeup in a good way. A lot of people talked, they remind him of Halliday, and he thinks that he can be the best pitcher in the league. And there he and they are not wrong. Again, to quote the great Alec Manoa, the stuff plays, man. Like when it's there, they can't get close to it. And I think, I don't know if it was that start against Washington that he was great, or it might have been the preseason, like kind of quasi spring training start against the Red Sox, where he had that changeup going like nuts. He's ridiculously talented. His stuff is ridiculous. But I guess the question, what do you think? Or I'll ask you, what do you think, what's next? If you're the Blue Jays and or Nate Pearson, what's next?
I mean, I think they have to start him on Saturday against the Philadelphia Phillies. I mean, first of all, consider that the alternative is starting Anthony Kay. And I do not think that that is a sound strategy for a team that is trying to compete and win ball games right now. But second of all, I just think that it'd be too devastating for him psychologically to get sent down after that. And the fact of the matter is, I am still tantalized by the prospect of the Blue Jays starting Nate Pearson. There's no reason to me that he shouldn't be able to, in his next start, be the Nate Pearson that we were promised. Having said that, all week leading up to his start, I'll be wondering, are we going to get this enigmatic guy who just looks plainly bad? I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, I still haven't seen something that leads me to believe that I don't want Nate Pearson on the mound. It's just been troubling what we've seen thus far.
I'll go one. I don't know if one step further is how I would describe it, but I will say that I want Nate Pearson to kind of go out and get his brains beat in a little bit, if that's what it's going to take. If it's either getting beat up, like I'd like to see him get hit hard. Which I referenced that start against Boston at Fenway in the, you know, last summer before the season really started, where he got hit hard by like three batters in a row, and then he sort of figured it out and went off on his way. And that to me was really instructive, and that was really encouraging, because it's important to get hit. But today it seemed like he was more afraid to get hit than he was afraid to challenge and to really just you know, again, no one's suggesting that he just go up there and just lay it down the middle of the plate and hope which I think is something we've seen him do before. When he starts to lose the strike zone a little bit, then you see him in that one start in particular just start to kind of aim like 94 down the middle instead of just letting it eat a little bit more. So I want to see him just continue. Like, I don't think there's anything for him to learn at AAA. The learning is this, right? The learning is going out and figuring out what he needs to do, where he needs to get his own himself in terms of his preparation or his in-game adaptations or whatever, he needs to figure out how he can get himself there to work with all the professionals around him and just be who he can be.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's a little bit concerning to me is that I don't know that he was consciously not being aggressive in the zone today. Okay, maybe with Michael Brantley, second out of the game, you know, he's missing low by a couple inches because he's really trying to scrape the bottom of the zone against a good left-handed hitter. Fine, maybe that's the case. But I think sort of from that point onward, I don't think he's consciously nibbling. I just think he has no idea where the ball is going when it leaves his hand. I don't think that he's like trying to pick corners with 98. Because you got to believe that he has enough confidence in his stuff. So like that's what's troubling to me. It's like, I think he's trying to be aggressive in the zone, especially with guys like Martin Maldonado or whatever scrub was playing for Carlos Correa today. But he's just not even close with his misses.
I think Ricky Romero, obviously former Blue Jays starter, former, you know, who has a podcast of his own. He on Twitter made a comment about it seemed like Nate Pearson was maybe rushing in terms of coming down the mound, maybe pulling off a little bit, shoulder flying open, you know, leaving him kind of exposed, release point all over the place. I'm more qualified to make a comment about that than I am about Nate Pearson's psychology, but if that's something that Ricky Romero is seeing, if that could be something else that someone other people are seeing, especially for a guy who was trying to make some mechanical tweaks in the minors and really trying to make them stick. So if that's it, if it's just a matter of allowing the pulse to come down a little bit so you can stay within your mechanics and stay and figure out how to be who you are, I think that can only happen in the big leagues. That can only happen from having, you know, quality conversations, from the quality of instruction and connection that he can make with, you know, Matt Bushman, with Pete Walker, with whoever it is they need to bring in just sit him down and talk with him. If it's another hitter, if it's God only knows, it could be anybody.
Man, the Blue Jays got to get him a copy of that Harvey Dorfman book that was so pivotal to Roy Halladay's transformation.
Of all the people, it would be nice. Not for Nate Pearson. It would be great if Roy Halladay was still alive, because that's fucked up still that he died. But that would be a great conversation for them to be able to sit down and talk. So, but yeah, it's a big question mark. But I think we'll see him on the mound again. I cannot imagine, especially given where they are, the Blue Jays are in terms of what the state of their pitching and what they need him to be. There's no time like the present to get to work on that development that cannot happen at the minor leagues. The only thing that's going to happen at the minor leagues is going to get bored and get more in his own head. Be like, why it's so easy down here? Why can't I do it when there's a third deck on the stadium? We'll see.
There's no more development to be done when you can just overpower guys with one pitch and don't have to work on anything because you're just that much better. But yeah, absolutely.
Throw that change up to that outside corner against lefties and you'll be good, Nate Pearson. That's me, pitching coach Drew. I'm making the circle change.
You would never call for a change up from me, for the record.
Well, because it just kind of sat there. I called for one and then I had to ask the umpire for another ball because it went over the goddamn fence.
Go get it out of the ocean.
Go get it out of the ocean. You mentioned Anthony Kay, who is a bit of... So Anthony Kay is easy to dump on. His numbers aren't great. A lot of Blue Jays fans. So I saw some people, you know, the kind of people that Wilner finds and find Wilner complaining about him not being a prospect, and why aren't people mad at Anthony Kay with as mad as they are at Nate Pearson? It's an apples to oranges, right? I wouldn't say Anthony Kay was a throw-in, but Anthony Kay was not the centerpiece of the Marcus Stroman trade. That was obviously Simeon Woods Richardson. Anthony Kay has, I think, a lot to offer. I don't think that Anthony Kay is going to be an ace, which is the difference between he and Nate Pearson. Anthony Kay was throwing 97 today. So, you know, I know you don't – that no one – a fool would say – would turn up their nose at that. His breaking stuff is not great. But I think that the Blue Jays are maybe not – haven't done – well, two things. I don't think they've put him in a position to succeed very often, but also I think that might be telling in terms of what they think Anthony Kay Cannon will be. So you don't think highly of Anthony Kay as a pitcher at all. So do you think this is just, they're just throwing him to the wolves because that's what he is?
Well, I think
don't back off. Don't back off.
No,
I got the receipts.
that You wouldn't dare.
I wouldn't.
I do think that that's something of an overstatement, and that those texts lack nuance because they can be a little bit emotional. Look, a left-hander who throws 97 and has a deep mix, there is probably going to be some value there. What I don't think is that Anthony Kay is a major league starter. I think that the secondary stuff is too lacking. And I think that the fastball command, I think the command profile overall is disastrous. And between the not really having an out pitch and the inability to hit spots, that's a really, really tough recipe to turn into a starting pitcher. And I think that the Blue Jays would be best served to maybe abandon that and just let him air it out, like Ryan Barucki coming in one or two inning stints, you know, maybe abandon one of those breaking balls and just become a two pitch guy and lean in to that. Cause you know, what we saw today was a great example of sort of where Anthony Kay is. Every batter goes to 3-2 and he can't put him away. You know, he's trying to like spin a breaking ball 3-2. It hangs up. Yordan Alvarez absolutely torches it, you know, 3-2 against anyone else, and he's like missing with the fastball. He got a gift call on the called strikeout of Alex Bregman. He just, you know, there's something there, but just because a guy's not a major league starter doesn't mean that he's completely valueless.
So my thing is that they're trying to do, again, they're not putting him necessarily in a position to succeed. So the Blue Jays today, it was in the fourth inning after Nate Pearson was yanked, they went to Joel Piamps as a more of a reliever, somebody who can get hot a little bit more quickly. Came in, got a couple quick outs to end the third, and then Piamps comes back out to start the fourth. Piamps gives up a home run, and then he gets a ground out, then he gets a strikeout. So now there's two outs, and you've got Yordan Alvarez at the plate, and they go to K. And this is when I was like, just for me, let Piamps face Alvarez. Right? Like, are you worried that Piamps is out of gas? You got an off day tomorrow. See if it gets out of hand, then you go to K. But K isn't, to me, he's not the guy you bring in at the end, in the middle of an inning. Let him start a clean inning. Let him get in there. Don't let him face the best hitter on the other team. Yordan Alvarez, for the record, is a freak of nature who in 500 plate appearances has like a one in his career, has a 180 weighted runs created plus. Like, he's insane. So maybe if you're trying to ease him in, you maybe don't want to use him as a bulk guy in a situation like this or moving forward, because God only knows what you're going to get from Nate Pearson. Maybe this is a bit of a safety net to have these two kind of in lockstep together. But I think that was something that I personally wouldn't have done, because that inning, right, to your point, you know, which is inarguable, Alvarez gets a hit because that's what he does. And then I think he walked the next guy. He walked Gurriel, and then Kyle Tucker hits a home run. And then at that point,
3-0 heater.
3-0 fastball that Kyle Tucker, who was having a dog shit year, hit a mile. That's all, you know, that all happened, right? Anthony Kay did all those things. But again, in my mind, because I'm looking for a reason to say, because then you look at the rest of the rest of the outing, which, you know, hardly dominant, hardly sparkling, but he was fine, right? That was the end of it.
Yeah. I mean, other than the assassination, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln?
But, well, that's not inaccurate. But I think that he's functional, if used in the right role, is my hope. Again, I get stars in my eyes. I see a guy who's left-handed, who's throwing 97, who is first time out this year, kind of got dinked and dunked, bad defense. Then he has his last outing, same sort of thing, just three clusters or like a bad six, eight, 9 minutes, and then the whole thing is undone. I guess that was in Oakland when he pitched. And then this time that, you know, they let him, once he ran out of hard, good hitters to face, he was fine. But I think that he could be better suited and maybe given a bit of more runway to get into a good start. That said, the Blue Jays are just telling us in a lot of ways what they think of Anthony Kay. And I think it's not different from what you said.
Yeah, very much so. And I also think, to your point, if you need to sort of manipulate the situation or you know, wait for a certain leverage index for him to be brought into the game and you're comfortable with that decision, what does that say to you about Anthony Kay? Like, that's not a endorsement of Anthony Kay that he needs it a clean inning.
But that's what the Rays do all day long, right? And they win 90 games every year. Like, again, why do you think Ryan Yarbrough's numbers look the way that they do? Because they ease him in. They take advantage of when he's in the – they put him – God, this is – son of a bitch. Last week, I'm praising the Royals. Then, and now this, here I am being like, give the Rays credit. This show has gone to hell. But
who are you?
They win ball games and they get the most out of guys like that by putting them into a position to succeed.
What I will say about Ryan Yarbrough is that he throws strikes. For his career, his walks per nine is like 2.1.
I'm not saying that Anthony Kay is Ryan Yarbrough. But
I'm saying there are elements there that make it clear why the Rays trust him and why he's been as effective as he has been. But with
he gets the face of the Robel Garcia, or the Garcias of the world.
But Anthony Kay is still walking the Robel Garcias of the world, and then he gets to face a good hitter who tees off on a 3-1 heater.
Actually, he struck him out. He struck out
Alex Jose Bregman. Altuve.
Yeah. He struck out Robel Garcia, and then he got lit up by Yordan Alvarez again, and then he got a couple ground outs.
And I will say, coming back to the decision to call on Kay when they did, I just thought that Charlie believed that the deficit could not get any bigger if they hoped to win the game, and that allowing Joel Piamps to face Yordan Alvarez was a recipe for a home run.
Letting anybody face Yordan Alvarez, honestly, is a recipe for a home run. It's not fair. He's good as hell. Let's no more bummer talk. Let's talk about something that's good and encouraging. If I asked you who was the Blue Jays team leader in home runs, would you have the answer?
I think it's a tie between Bo Bichette and Marcus Semien.
I think you might be right. But one of those names is not like the other, in that Marcus Semien...
one of them's a shortstop. Hi-yo!
Boom. And neither of them are Vladimir Guerrero Jr. not leading the team in home runs.
I don't think your boy's gone deep since that three-homer game against the Nationals, by the way.
He has two extra base hits in May, but we're not here to talk about that right
sorry,
now.
Sorry, no more bummer talk. I'm sorry.
We've had enough bummer talk. What we're going to do is talk about Marcus Semien playing great. Marcus Semien got off to a dreadful start. He was at the top of the lineup, felt a little bit miscast up there, wasn't really doing a lot. And now, you know, lo and behold, you look at his numbers and he's having a great season. He's offensively having a better season than Bo Bichette, as an example. Just again, I'm not comparing them, but their output at this point is quite similar. Marcus Semien has drawn a few more walks. But again, he had two hits today. He's up to a 125 weighted runs created plus, which is to say that he's 25% above league average. It's May, and you know, 3 weeks ago this was not the case. But he looks great, hitting the ball hard, playing great defense at second base, running the bases. He leads the team in stolen bases and hitting the ball over the fence. This is what the Blue Jays paid for. This is what they signed up for. And maybe it was, well, it started before the trip to Oakland, but hopefully that trip to Oakland, a little bit of home cooking, is exactly what he needed, because he looks like a guy worth $18.5 million a year right now.
Oh, very much so. I mean, it looked like he was starting to lock in that series against Atlanta that the Blue Jays swept, and then returning to Oakland was absolutely the cure for, I guess, what ailed him. Because early on, he was sort of swinging and missing a lot in the zone, not making a ton of quality contact, and also expanding more than I thought he would. And I, too, felt that he was terribly miscast as a leadoff guy, and it wasn't really consistent with his career numbers. But since then, he's looked great. Way more locked in, driving the ball way more consistently, spraying the ball more regularly. It certainly helps that the Crawford boxes are a bit of a joke, and he just managed to flick one out there on Saturday to to nudge the Blue Jays to victory. But that notwithstanding, his plate appearances have been way more competitive. He's not behind in the count as much as he was in the early going. And absolutely, he's been their steadiest infield defender, you know, with honorable mention to Vlad at first base. But yeah, he has been, frankly, at the rate he's playing, a bargain at $18 million, because he's on pace for something like a 5-WAR season or something. And even though it got off to something of an inauspicious start, you know, the numbers are absolutely there. And even when he, you know, wasn't hitting in the early going, he was still running into one every now and then. And you can't give the Blue Jays enough credit for that pickup.
No, and obviously full credit to him for kind of staying within himself. I don't think anybody's expecting him to have the same kind of season as he did in 2019 when he was, you know, an MVP candidate, basically like an 8-win guy. But right now he looks great. Again, his walk rate is strong, you know, above average. Consistent with the last few years. Strikeout rate a little bit higher, which again I think could be owed to some of the stuff that you were saying in terms of him missing in the zone, missing pitches in the zone, and not exactly looking, you know, looking 100% comfortable. But it's great to have a player who has also, you know, moved across the diamond a few times, played a little bit of short. Especially when Bo Bichette was in need of a bit of a break after having a couple of rough games defensively, you can't say enough. I don't think that anyone. I mean, I don't think it's unrealistic to think that somewhere between here and like a little bit worse is not unfair to say that this is who he can be. He is a good hitter. And while, you know, everyone's allowed to have a career year, and he did just that in 2019. To come even 80% of that, I think everybody's going to be pretty happy.
Oh, everyone would be thrilled. I mean, look, he was like an 8-win player in 2019. It was absolutely outrageous. If he even approached that, I think that everyone would be thrilled. But, you know, ultimately, he's a high floor guy. You know, like, he is probably at worst going to be a league average hitter while providing steady defense and contributing on the base paths. You know, he's an all around producer. And I think that the Blue Jays very much valued a guy who is high floor and reliable, given how much sort of high variance there is throughout the entire roster, both in terms of position players and in their staff. So I think that they really valued that reliability, and also baked into their 1-year calculation the fact that there's also quite a bit of upside. And right now, you know, if he sort of continues to perform at the rate that he has for the rest of the season, like, what are they getting in terms of value? Like, you know, 4 times what they paid him. It's outrageous. He's been a real boon for the Blue Jays.
He's not alone. I wanted to just take a quick second and Kevin Biggio had a pretty good series. Obviously, he had a great game on Saturday. He had a home run, drew a couple walks. He's starting to get up, threatening league average. I was really happy with a Bo Bichette plate appearance here on Sunday against Zach Greinke. Obviously, Zach Greinke is a unique pitch starter in terms of how he doesn't throw very hard and he loves to throw. Pat Tabler could not stop talking about the changeup to inside changeup to righties.
To Vlad, yeah.
Well, and he was doing it to everybody. So it was Bo Bichette's second plate appearance, and he went up there and I tweeted about this, that he had a plan. He was like, I'm going to stay back and hit the ball the other way. And he was just sat back, and everything that was thrown, you could tell that was his goal. It wasn't even a plan. It was like, this is what I'm going to do. I was a little, in some ways, I'm surprised that Greinke and Maldonado didn't try to like jam him inside or come back, just because from where I was sitting, it was clearly evident that Bichette was trying to go the other way. There was a cute moment in that at bat where Greinke threw like the 67 mile an hour curveball that I don't know how or why Bo Bichette went over there and fished it out and knocked it foul, and was all kind of laughing and chuckling and chatting it away with Martin Maldonado, who I love as a catcher to watch. He's so much fun back there. He's such a good defensive catcher. Not Gold a great Glover. Hitter. Gold Glover, dead in the water. A great relay play featuring Kevin Biggio and Lourdes Gurriel Jr. And then Bichette slashed a solid single to right. And it was great. And you know, he's never going to be a guy who draws a ton of walks, but he can hit, and that's not a bad thing to have at all.
And he makes adjustments, right? He adjusts mid at bat, he adjusts mid game. And the approach with two strikes is really impressive too, because you know, he really makes a conscious effort to shorten up and put the ball in play, hit the ball where it's pitched, because the swings that he takes early in counts are absolutely ridiculous. Like, this is a guy who loves to let it eat. Mm-hmm. And I mean, to be honest with you, I'm surprised at how frequently he swings and misses on what I feel are hittable pitches in like 0-0 counts or 0-1 counts. But anyways, when he does get to two strikes, he noticeably tempers the leg kick, the swing, and really focuses on getting the bat on the ball. He is inclined a little bit to expand the zone. And like you said, like he's an aggressive hitter. He's never going to lead the league in walk rate. If he ever gets to double digits in that, I think that'd be tremendous progress for him. But yeah, he's a hitter. He's a hitter and he's hitterish and he knows how to adjust and he understands situations.
More spin rate coming up right after these words from our sponsors. I want to take a quick look ahead. I don't want to take too much more of your time, Jonah, who is filling in admirably. Thank you again. I'm so happy that you made this work for me and for us. What do you think about the lineup coming up? Now, they're going to be in National League ballparks, which means they lose the designated hitter. Rowdy Tellez lost one out to deep right field today, but he's the odd man out, right? Like, I don't think at this point, especially with Kevin Biggio looking a little bit more like himself, that the Blue Jays are going to run any risks by moving Vlad over to third base, even for a game.
No chance. Yeah. It's Rowdy who sits and he'll be the first bat off the bench to pinch hit for the pitcher. And you know, if I had my druthers, I would still move Biggio down, I think, it's complicated by the fact that they're heading to Atlanta, but you know, moving forward, I think that I would still have him sort of in that 8 or 9 spot as a sort of quote unquote secondary leadoff hitter. I don't like him with his profile in the middle of the lineup, which is where Charlie seems inclined to hit him a little bit, in that 6 spot. And, you know, with his contact issues and his profile, I don't really love that. In Atlanta, I think it's definitely going to be Rowdy who's the odd man out. And I really think that you're not going to see Vlad at third, you know, barring more injuries, more than, you know, a couple times this year.
I think that if I was making the lineup, I would hit Kevin Biggio lower in the order for two reasons. Number one is, well, for the reasons that you laid out, in terms of his ability to do damage at the plate when there maybe are runners on base. Of course, he jumped on a fastball on Saturday and hit it out, but that's just not who he has been. I think the vast majority of his value, I think, comes from his ability to get on base through walks. And if they shift him, he's got to continue to try to punish them with bunts, which I think is a value at the bottom of the order. And when the Blue Jays are playing in a National League ballpark, if they're going to lose the DH, given the shape of their roster right now, because they don't really, because their only other outfielder is Jonathan Davis, I would move Biggio down in the order, because if you get wild with it in one of these games and you want to double switch Vlad to third, and then if you're hitting, you know, Tellez is going to be, you know, hitting in the pitcher spot and playing first, and the pitcher spot's going to be in Biggio's spot or whatever, I would consider moving him down to seventh or eighth eighth at the lowest, because I think that you have that little bit of flexibility. And then again, same thing with double switches. If it's not him, it could be somebody else, right? If you're double switching, maybe Gurriel. They've shown a lot of willingness to take Gurriel out. When it comes to defense, he seems to be the guy that kind of gets to lose his job a little bit. So I think that there's value in that. The other thing this is sort of tangentially related, and it comes back to that Anthony Kay thing, which is, I'm a little bit, maybe I shouldn't be surprised. For the Blue Jays front office, the way they like to think, the way that they are using all the available information that's at their fingertips, and it comes back to that choice, the idea of bringing in Kay to face Alvarez just for the platoon advantage. Jordan Alvarez destroys left-handed pitching. He destroys right-handed pitching. He's marginally worse in a very small sample. But to me, again, in that instance, it's not worth the platoon advantage to put Kay in that position. And then when it comes to Kevin Biggio, for example, today, and I texted this to you today about Kevin Biggio against Zach Greinke is a nightmare matchup for Biggio, because unless he wants to, Greinke's never going to walk a guy like Kevin Biggio. He has too much trash that he can throw and keep him off balance. So to me, that the recognizing that this is a tough matchup for him, just like it is if he's a good lefty, I would think in that situation, I think this there's more value moving Biggio down today rather than the guy on Saturday. What was Christian Javier? Yeah. Who's coming up there throwing high heat or throwing gas. And if Biggio runs into one, it goes over out, right? Where with there's too much work for Biggio to be able to touch somebody like Greinke. So I think they should maybe move him down the order. But for all of the raziness and all of the Montoyo, he is really by the book a lot of the time. And it's, I don't know if disappointing is the word. Maybe I'm just surprised that he's not playing, doing more 4D chess as opposed to just doing it strictly by the book.
Where's the Rays brain? You know, he spent decades in that organization, but he's pretty meat and potatoes, pretty conventional, at least from a lineup construction point of view.
I mean, there's value in having a lefty in the middle of the lineup, especially without Tellez, I guess. But again, not all lefty-righty matchups are created equal.
Yeah, no, exactly. And again, I think he has something of a like surprisingly antiquated commitment to the idea, oh, you need balance in the lineup. You know, like that takes precedent over just intuitively constructing the lineup based on the abilities of the individual hitters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm always surprised. I think that there should be more. It's not me, but like, what kind of pitcher is a good matchup? What kind of result can we expect from a given hitter in a given pitcher? And typically, if I had the power to do the things, obviously there's a lot more interpersonal dynamics that are involved with that, and the idea of if you move player X into this spot, maybe they're not as comfortable. That was a lot of the talk in the spring when it came to Simeon Springer in the leadoff spot. But good players are good players, and they're going to be who they are almost all the time, I think, is the one thing that we've seen. As long as they're put in a position to succeed, I'll come back to that, free Anthony K. But yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how they build that out.
Yeah, and I will say, to your point, I think that Kevin Biggio is a great example of maybe not being put in the best situation to succeed, because I think what they did to him in terms of taking him, and putting him at third base because they signed Marcus Semien, you know, they displaced him from the one position on the infield where I think he can be average to plus, and forced him into a completely unfamiliar position that he probably doesn't have the physical attributes to play at a high level, if even competently. And I think that that's really difficult. And now he's like bouncing all over the place, third, right field, you know, sort of wherever they need a guy. And, you know, I am sympathetic to that. And it does make me, I guess, a little bit more understanding of some of the struggles that he's going through defensively and also on the offensive side of things.
I think that's the team building calculus though, right? Because if you're the Blue Jays, you're like, we can leave Kevin Biggio at second base and we know he's going to be hit the best version of himself there. Right. And maybe they don't want to tell him how to hit or be more aggressive or less aggressive. We can hope and assume that those are decisions that Kevin Biggio came to on his own. But if you're the Blue Jays and you're thinking, is the best version of Kevin Biggio at second base better for our team than the high floor version of Marcus Semien? And they answered that, just like they've done it in the outfield. Is the best version of our team with the right field version of Kevin Biggio? Again, they've made that point with the moves and the transactions that they've made. It's interesting, and I think it's telling as well, because I mentioned that relay play that they won, the Blue Jays threw Martin Maldonado out of the plate today. Great play by Gurriel in the outfield. Get rid of it quickly. Nice, accurate throw from Biggio. I find when Biggio, you know, in that case, and when you see him in right field, his arm looks pretty good. He's got a strong arm. I just don't think that I think he's too rushed at third base. It doesn't seem like he either needs a bit more time, needs to kind of gear up for it, because at third base, the arm does not look as strong as it does when he's making those longer throws from right field or that throw from the shallow left today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, completely agree.
With that, no, every good podcast has to be based on a basis of I completely agree. I'm going to let you go. This has been great. Jonah, where can the people find you on social media, on Twitter, where they can get your fire takes as you quote yourself?
If you like, Simpsons memes and no, that's pretty much it. Hit me up at Bierenball, BIRENBALL.
At Bierenball on Twitter. He is my friend and I'm always excited to talk to him. Jonah Bierenbaum, thank you so much. This was great.
Oh, feeling is mutual, pal. Thanks for having me.